Scorpius Biomanufacturing offers cGMP manufacturing for biologics entering clinical trials. Translating research from an academic lab to first-in-human trials requires a hands-on manufacturing partner. Scorpius works closely with tech transfer offices, licensing teams, and scientists to help make biological research available to patients in need. Learn more today at scorpiusbiologics.com or through the link in the show notes.
You're listening to Autumn on the Air, the weekly podcast that brings you conversations about the impact of research commercialization and the people who make it happen. Join us for interviews with patent and licensing professionals, innovators, entrepreneurs, and tech transfer leaders on the issues and trends that matter most. Keep listening for an inside track on the people, IP policies, and politics changing our world.
In an era when universities are increasingly viewing their intellectual property portfolios as lucrative sources of potential revenue, navigating the complexities of university industry partnerships has become more critical than ever. Today, I'm thrilled to have Donald Siegel join us to discuss university industry partnerships as highlighted in his book, The Chicago Handbook of University Technology Transfer and Academic Entrepreneurship. Don is a foundation professor of public policy and management at Arizona State University and co-executive director of the Global Center for Technology Transfer. With a distinguished career that includes serving as Dean of the School of Business at the University of Albany SUNY and editing prominent journals like the Journal of Technology Transfer, he brings unparalleled expertise in university technology transfer and academic entrepreneurship. Don, along with his co-editors, has created a definitive handbook that synthesizes state-of-the-art research and offers invaluable insights from experts across various disciplines. Today, we'll explore key themes from the book, including the evolution of technology transfer, strategies for managing intellectual property, fostering an entrepreneurial culture within universities, and much more. Welcome, Don. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, and I thought we would kick things off. You know, every great project starts with some type of spark of inspiration. So I'd really love to hear what inspired you and your co-editors to compile the Chicago Handbook of University Technology Transfer and Academic Entrepreneurship.
Well, all three of us are academics. Unfortunately, Mike Wright passed away several years ago. But we've all been studying tech transfer since the mid-90s, and we've seen the field evolve as an academic field. I happen to be a member of a cult, and it's a cult of academics who study tech transfer. And this cult has been growing. There's now people in multiple disciplines who've been studying it, and it's a global phenomenon. So we decided that we would do something that was highly unusual. We would approach the University of Chicago Press. And if you know something about that press, you know it mainly publishes in the social sciences and humanities. Very rarely have they published anything related to business or management. And we said, look, this field is growing. There's a lot of academics studying it. A lot of interesting things going on in the policy world. We have a collection of great contributors from around the world, from places like MIT, Stanford, Imperial College, Columbia, places like that, who are doing pathbreaking research on this topic. And we want to put it all together. We want you to do a handbook. They had never done a handbook before.
Was it a difficult sell?
Yes, because they've never done a handbook. They've never done anything on a topic like tech transfer. But I don't even think they've done anything on innovation, much less technology transfer. But we wanted to make a statement to the academics, that's who we deal with, that this is a really serious topic. We've got great scholars, important evidence, managerial and public policy evidence. And we were able to arrange this. And we think, you know, it's really a collection of a leading edge research on the topic. And that was the spark. That was the inspiration to really make that statement, to get Chicago Press behind it. And we were able to do that.
And it's a great book, too. You have 9 chapters. And the one that caught my attention that I thought was pretty interesting is that you've got an entrepreneur's guide to the university in there, which I thought was really clever to include a chapter on that, because I haven't seen that dealt with very often from that perspective.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we had the Stanford people in on that one, Stanford Technology Ventures partners. I was out there a couple of years ago. It's an incredible operation. We also had a paper from some folks at MIT who talked a lot about startups as well. I think one of the trends that was really important when the handbook came out was open innovation in the context of tech transfer. So we made sure to cover that. And then, of course, we had a chapter that I wrote with Mike on technology transfer offices and how they've evolved over time. So there's a lot of interesting kind of managerial and policy issues that are addressed in the special issue, you know, in the volume. And I think I'd encourage people to look at it.
Absolutely. I would agree. And I think one of the things that, you know, came to me was, you know, as you're going through the handbook, it's obviously very clear that tech transfers come a long way. So could you share with us some of the major milestones and turning points in its history? And I'm curious how these milestones and turning points have influenced today's practices and strategies for tech transfer offices.
Well, the major change that I've seen, now, I started studying tech transfer offices in the mid-1990s. And the first 3 people I interviewed are legends in the field. Lita Nelson at MIT, Kathy Koo at Stanford, and Mark Kroll, who was the president of Autumn, had been a transfer director at multiple institutions, NC State, UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, and was also a high-level research official at the University of Virginia. And what I saw in the beginning, in the mid-90s, was that you mostly had lawyers in the tech transfer offices. You had very few people with business and entrepreneurial experiences. And that has changed dramatically. Tech transfer offices they've moved beyond licensing and patenting to really a much greater focus on entrepreneurship and the role of the tech transfer office in the whole innovation and entrepreneurial ecosystem at the university. So tech transfer offices have evolved, and they've become a really important part of the overall innovation and entrepreneurial ecosystem of the university. And they're dealing with alumni. This is another trend. This was something we did when I was a business school dean. Well, several things going on. Number one, a lot of them are working with business schools now. And that's a real best practice, in my opinion, when they do work with business schools. But they're also working more closely with alumni. Alumni commercialization funds, all of these things were novel. You know, when I went to Autumn meeting in 1996, I think that was my first one, there were no venture capital firms there. There were no surrogate entrepreneurs. Maybe they had just started having some entrepreneurs in residence, stuff like that, but no connection at all to the entrepreneurial world. And that's changed dramatically. The second thing that's changed, and I think this is good as well, is there's a much greater appreciation within Autumn and at the university of the role of tech transfer in economic development. The tech transfer is an engine of economic and social development in the region. And policymakers are starting to get it at the state level, the regional level. And that's affected tech transfer offices in a good way. And I think they've evolved in terms of their managerial practices a lot. I'll talk about what some of those best practices are, in my opinion, based on the research that I've done, and also what we've seen in the journal and some other special issues I've edited. A lot of change. And autumn is completely different. And then, of course, one thing I'm very excited about, because one of the arguments I've been making is academics need to focus more on federal labs, the tech transfer at federal labs. And then, we heard several years ago about the collaboration between FLC and Autumn is really exciting, because tech transfer at the federal labs is really, based on what we've tried, learned in our NSF research, funded research, is at a much more embryonic stage. There's a lot that the FLC folks can learn from Autumn members. So that's also changed.
Yeah, and I think that's a great collaboration, as you mentioned, Autumn and the FLC. I wanted to go back to something you said. You said that Autumn has changed a lot. So I'm curious, having studied, obviously, tech transfer and Autumn and its evolution. Talk to us a little bit about how it's changed.
Well, as I said, I think you now have more tech transfer professionals who have real business experience, not just an MBA, but real business experience and entrepreneurial experience. So there's a real strong entrepreneurial component to what the tech transfer does, who they interact with. They're also much more closely tied, because one of the things we first started studying, and there's also another army of academics who study this, are what I would call property-based institutions designed to promote tech transfer, like incubators, accelerators, science and technology parks. I also find that tech transfer offices are much more aware of what's going on at those property-based institutions, and also more aware of what's going on at the university, in the business schools, in the engineering schools. See, one of the things that I've learned by studying tech transfer officers and professionals is how important their educational role is. They play a very important role in educating the faculty and administrators about the value of tech transfer, and increasingly alumni, I hope, as well, about the value of tech transfer. And, this strikes at the core of the mission of a research university. I mean, you would not believe how seriously this is taken at my university. I mean, our president, President Michael Crow, is not only an expert on tech transfer, but it permeates the institution. This idea that of doing use-inspired basic research, that the research that you do is going to have value to the economy, to society. We get the message. And, not all universities are like that, but more and more are.
Yeah, recognizing the necessity of doing that, the economic impact. And like you said, if the public would only, if we could get the general public to appreciate the value of university-driven research, I think that would go a long way as well.
Yeah, and the Autumn, Better World Project is a great way of articulating that. I know that the federal labs also do a good job of promoting the social value, economic value of the technologies that they work on. And this all gets back to federal R&D. I mean, this is about, and it's true that I was inspired to do the handbook to make a point to academics, but I was trained as an academic economist. And then I came across a group of economists at my university and Harvard who study innovation and try to quantify the social returns to innovation, especially basic research. And I found that really fascinating because what we found in the academic literature is that the social returns to basic research, which is really what we're talking about when we talk about tech transfer, you're talking about maximizing the value to the economy, to society, of the research that we do at the university. And there are people like me and my mentors who try to quantify that. And anyone who studies innovation has to study two things eventually. One is the role of the university, and you could add federal labs in innovation because they do most of the basic research. And the second, of course, is entrepreneurship. And whatever it takes to get the innovations to the marketplace. And more importantly, to societal use. The market is just a mechanism to get it into the hands of people. And, you know, and there's all kinds of issues around that. And we haven't talked about that, you know, IP and who owns the IP and everything else. But I don't care about that as much as I care about the social value of the technology.
Now, given all the research you've done, Don, you know, I'm sure you're well aware that tech transfer offices often face some pretty significant challenges. What do you see as some of the most pressing issues they encounter today? And have you seen any innovative solutions or strategies in your research that effectively address some of these obstacles?
I have. The biggest challenge is resources. Tech transfer offices, you know, I never thought I would say this because I was a university administrator for 20 years and a dean for 8 years and other assignments. And I never, you know, most university offices are not underfunded. But tech transfer offices are under-resourced. And again, I think part of the reason for that is that our stakeholders do not understand the social and economic value of tech transfer. So they, you know, and maybe even some of our university leaders don't. So that, as a result, those TTOs are under-resourced. And of course, patenting is very expensive. IP protection, and a lot of universities and even now federal labs can't afford patenting. So I would say resources are the main problem. The solutions, there are several solutions. I think one, and this is a very favorable trend, would be the TTOs working with development offices. Being much more engaged with donors. And by the way, faculty can be donors. One of the largest donations, I believe, in NYU history was from a scientist who engaged in tech transfer successfully and gave back money to NYU. So I think, you know, that's one solution. Alumni commercialization funds are another solution. Really trying to get government to appreciate, I think, the entrepreneurial dimension of tech transfer is a way to generate more resources, and making use of, you know, human capital at the university. As I said before, I think that many of the TTOs that are most successful, particularly your representative state universities, are ones that work with business schools and take advantage of, you know, that talent that exists that can be deployed in the tech transfer realm.
You know, you've talked a lot so far about the kind of entrepreneurial culture in universities, and it's so critical. Have you seen some creative or unconventional methods that universities have used to ignite entrepreneurship
among faculty and students?
One of the mechanisms I discussed was the use of business school students to get engaged in tech transfer. But when I was a business school dean, and I was for 8 years, I used to say that if I said two words to donors, and business school deans are always out engaging in extortion, I mean fundraising, right? You know, so we're always trying to raise money. If I said two words to an alum, those two words are students and entrepreneurship, they would give us money. So the important thing, I think, and again, this gets back to alumni engagement, is the alumni will support two things: getting students engaged in research. We've seen that at multiple institutions, all these undergraduate research initiatives, but also getting them engaged in entrepreneurship and tech transfer indirectly, if they're doing research, is one way to do that. I also think that we tried to tie as much as we could tech transfer to economic and social development in the region. And so if you can convince a funder to support, as we did, student startups that are technology-based, then, you know, that I thought that was creative. And then, in terms of igniting entrepreneurship among faculty and students, there are also, of course, you know, managerial practices that you can incentivize that, not just with money, but in other ways. What we've seen, for example, even at the federal labs, they have entrepreneurial leave. Some of them have entrepreneurial leave programs. And another way that governments, state governments, have tried to incentivize entrepreneurial activity among faculty and students is SBIR, STTR matching programs in various states to incentivize the creation of startups by faculty, students. A lot of the SBIR, I was on the National SBIR Committee and wrote a few papers on that, so I know the program very well. A lot of the SBIR startups have former students, postdocs, people like that, as founders. Not to mention STTR, which has an academic founder. So any kind of a program that incentivizes that is another method I've seen that works. So yeah, those are some of it.
And I think along those same lines, you know, balancing academic responsibilities with entrepreneurial pursuits at a university can be challenging, and I'm sure you've seen that as well. So along the same lines, how do you think universities can design policies or incentives that help faculty to manage these dual roles without compromising their primary academic commitments?
Well, I am in favor of, yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with Rich Carter at Oregon State University. But he's got a project that's funded, I think, by the National Science Foundation to try to reform promotion and tenure.
Yes, it's gotten a lot of press, that program.
And it's a great program. And I've noticed that most of the land-grant universities have now adopted some way of rewarding tech transfer in promotion and tenure. And that is really important. And so that's one way to do it. What we've shown in our academic research is that changing the royalty distribution formulas, like, let me give an example. We had a paper where we looked at tech transfer performance at universities, and we asked the following questions. A research question was, do universities that have a royalty distribution formula that, you know, is kind of more faculty friendly. Because as you know, that varies. At some universities, faculty only get a third of the revenue, whereas at other universities, they get maybe two thirds of the revenue. Is there any relationship between that share and the performance of the university? And it turns out there is. That universities that have a hot, allow a larger share of the revenue to be given to the faculty member tend to do better because it incentivizes the faculty to become engaged in tech transfer. So incentives matter, culture matters, hiring the right department chairs. You know, it's so funny because we've done a bunch of these qualitative studies, which means we go out in the field and we interview chemistry department chairs, for example. And, you know, it's funny, within the same field at comparable institutions, you talk to some department chairs and they know everything there is to know about the chemistry department's patent portfolio and the value of it and other kinds of mechanisms of tech transfer. They're totally up to speed. And you talk to their rival institution, you talk to the department chair there, he doesn't even know whether they have patents or what the value of those patents are, much less. So you have to hire university leaders that value this as an activity, and not just in promotion and tenure, that too, but, you know, that really think this is important as a priority for the department or the school or the college. And, you know, I think there's been a generational change, though. We found two things, because, again, we interviewed people and conducted some surveys in the 90s and now in this decade. Faculty today are much more receptive to tech transfer and entrepreneurship than they were 30 years ago. And they're also more interested in the social value of, and again, I was not convinced of that. I'm an economist. So I think people are greedy. You know, I think people want money. They're interested. You know, we did these interviews and we interviewed faculty to try to figure out why are you doing this? What, you know, it's very timely. It takes you away from your basic research. Why are you doing it? And I was shocked. You know, so many faculty are doing it because of the social value of the innovation and the tech transfer. And that was not the case 30 years ago. So I'm seeing a change. This, what we call, and I sent you the title of the article coming out, which is pro-social tech transfer. It's really a phenomenon. And by the way, there are very well-defined ways of measuring that because what we did in our more recent research after the handbook was published is really get down into the workplace and interview tech transfer managers and survey them and survey the faculty to try to get an understanding of what motivates them beyond money. And we found out some very interesting things about that. One is they want to be treated fairly by the university and the tech transfer office, that what the human resource management people call organizational justice in tech transfer is very important. So you have to treat the faculty fairly and be efficient and treat them with respect. And as an administrator, I know that that can be frustrating because there's a lot of cognitive dissonance in academia, believe me. I could tell you stories. But treating them fairly is important. But just as important is this idea that faculty are committed. And if you think about it, it makes sense because they've devoted their lives to developing the technology. They could make more money in the private sector. Nobody's doing this to be rich. No, they're doing it because, yeah, they get notoriety from the publishing and from patenting a little bit and citations and all that. But they really believe in the social value and how tech transfer benefits people. That is a major motivating factor for them. And again, that surprised me as an economist.
I would think so. And you also sent me a paper that you just recently had come out with David Balderman that talked about, you know, when faculty, students, the people in the federal labs, they bypass the TTO. They do what you, I think you referred to as deviant technology transfer. And some of the things you talked about in that paper were, you know, the if there isn't that organizational justice type of thing in there. But, you know, you also dove into the psychological issues as well. Do you want to talk about that as well?
Yes, I think that the other thing that we found had found is important is the importance of championing and leadership. So it's important to have tech transfer role models. And often those are senior colleagues. You know, academia is still very hierarchical. It's structured that way for a reason. And I don't think that's ever going to change. And I know it, I was affected by my mentors. I mentioned this earlier. I said my mentors studied the social value of innovation, tried to quantify it. They understood the importance of it. And that affected me. And so what we're seeing is that department chairs, deans, PIs in a lab, because we get down to the lab level and we conduct surveys of individuals within a lab, they are very much affected, and not just postdocs. Postdocs are definitely affected by championing leadership, but even junior faculty are the same way. And now, some of their champions and some of their mentors may not be at the university. They may be at other universities, but that is very important. The other thing that's important, and again, this is another kind of an OB or organizational behavior issue, is identity. You're asking a scientist. So think about the typical academic scientist, let's say PhD in biology. They're trained to be a scientist. They're not trained to be an entrepreneur. They're not trained to think about how to commercialize their innovation or whether the innovation has commercial potential. So what programs like I-Corps do, and I-Corps is not the only one, but your listeners are familiar with that program, is they try to help a scientist develop a new identity. It's like a secret agent, you know, like in the old days, I'm dating myself, but you have a different identity. Now, of course, we all have different identities. We have identities as a parent, as a spouse, as a colleague, as a scientist, but now you're asking them to assume a new identity. And that creates a lot of conflict for many scientists. They're not, you know, it's troubling to some. They don't think of themselves as an entrepreneur or as a someone who needs to deal with the applications of their research so much. So we're trying to understand that as well. We have a paper that we're working on now, which looks at the role of, and again, this is consistent with the same idea of people having role conflict, and because they're assuming a new identity, is the role of ambivalence.
Interesting.
A lot of faculty are ambivalent. You know, should I do this or not? Is it the right thing to do? And they're, how do they deal with that? So when you go down this road, and we've been arguing now for the last, I guess it's about 9 years now, and trying to publish a few papers on this, we really have to look at the human side of tech transfer. We really have to look at that, the issues that I mentioned, and in addition, DEI, and in addition, work-life balance. And this came into prominence during the pandemic when schools were shut down. So we have a paper where we looked at, you know, all the consequences of that created, you know, we now have in many fields a growing percentage of women in the scientific workforce at universities and federal labs. But then the pandemic comes, schools are shut down, it creates all kinds of difficulties with work-life balance. And there's a question about how that affects, you know, tech transfer. We really don't know yet. We're trying to figure that out.
That's really interesting because no one has looked at that before. That's a very emerging type of topic, to your point.
And I am like the Willie Loman of tech transfer. You know, I'm out there trying to get scholars in fields like human resource management or organizational behavior to try to work on these issues. You know, you guys study work-life balance. You study DEI. You study identity. You study leadership. Why not apply it in this wonderful context, which has great societal importance? Let's learn more about that. And that's something that we're trying to do. And we'd like to do it systematically across universities. Right now, we're doing it at a few universities and federal labs. But yeah, so I think there's that human dimension, and that needs more exploration. And again, we have, if any of your listeners are interested, I could send you, you know, any kind of work that we've been doing on this. But we're encouraging, you know, other academics to explore these topics. And they're starting to pay attention. So there's going to be more and more academics poking around this activity. And one of the things I didn't mention is there's actually more interest in tech transfer academically abroad.
Why do you think that is?
Because they're behind us. They're trying to figure out how to do a better job. You know, and I saw this when I was in England. There was a lot of envy, U.S. envy. Should we adopt Baidoa? Should we do all of these things? You know, by the way, that's another trend I've observed at the autumn meetings, is now there's a much stronger international presence.
It's been growing for quite some time, yes.
Yeah. And in the old days, you know, there were maybe one or two from Europe at most. And now, you know, everybody realizes that, you know, American universities do a good job of tech transfer. They really do. We lead the world and we know how to manage it. And other countries are interested in learning from our experience. And other academics there's a lot of academics internationally that have studied this. And by the way, one of our co-editors was British, and he did a lot of work with Oral, if that's still around, which I think it is. And there was another European network. I forgot the name of it. But
oh, yeah. Praxis Oral, I think it goes by now, maybe STP, ASTP, maybe?
Yes, that's right. And so we've worked with a lot of those academics. And, you know, they're also interested in science parks, incubators, you know, all that. And there's also a lot of people who study that abroad. And again, I would say there's more interest in especially the property-based institutions abroad than in the U.S., especially in Asia, the Middle East, where they built these, what would you call them, you know, these huge science and technology parks.
I know in Saudi Arabia, they've done that. We had someone on the podcast about a year or so ago that the government there has thrown massive amounts of money into the creating first, you know, some of the largest technology parks in the world is their goal. So, yes.
Well, Mark is working with them. Mark Kroll, I know he's advised a lot of governments in the Middle East on this. And again, you know, I think it's good. You know, I left somebody out because and I forgot him. I actually saw him in D.C. John Fraser too, from Florida State. See, the other thing that's exciting for me, because we do have our center, a global center for tech transfer, is the fact that tech transfer now, this is another major trend. NSF basically has a new directorate that's basically focused on tech transfer. I mean, it's incredible. And the first new directorate in 30 years at NSF, and it's focused on tech transfer. And it's called Technology Innovation Partnerships. And one of those programs is called, and we're part of it, it's called Accelerating Research Translation. I'm not sure if your listeners have followed that, but I went to the two national conferences, one of which was organized by Marianne Feldman, who's in our center. And there were so many Autumn people there. It was like going to an academic version of Autumn. Because tech transfer has become one of the most important missions at NSF. And when I say, you know, how do I know something is important? Again, I'm an economist, is money. They're spending money on these programs like ART. They've taken over ICOR. But they also have regional innovation engines. A lot of those, we have one, is really focused on tech transfer. I would call it tech transfer. So it's really great to see tech transfer as a priority at what used to be a pure basic research or, you know, institution, NSF.
So, Don, I wanted to ask you, for those of our listeners who are tech transfer professionals who are listening to this podcast and they really want to make a difference, what immediate actions do you think they can take to boost their impact and foster a thriving innovation ecosystem?
What can tech transfer professionals do? Well, I have to be honest with you. I think that we need more attention. I think there needs to be more marketing. More successful marketing of tech transfer, not just on externally, but within the university. And I don't know how professionals, it really falls on leaders, the people who run the tech transfer offices. And they're called different things, as you know. There are lots of, you see, tech transfer for some people is a pejorative term. You know, by the way, I think tech transfer, and this is reflected in the title of our handbook, has really morphed into something more general that we call academic entrepreneurship. So I think, you know, subtle things like that, messaging matters, and really getting the word out on what the social value is of the tech transfer and who the, you know, successful faculty are because of this human dimension that I mentioned earlier. I really think, you know, I have seen tech transfer professionals become really engaged in the curriculum. I think that's important too. I don't think it's a bad idea to have tech transfer professionals teaching courses because this should be part of the curriculum, you know, and not just in engineering.
Yeah, and that would get the word of it out as a potential career as well, which a lot of postdocs and others don't even realize it's a career possibility.
Exactly. And that's always been a problem. I can tell you where it's a huge problem is on the DEI side. Is it's been very hard to get minorities interested in tech transfer as a profession.
I completely agree with you. I'm the chair of the Autumn EDI committee, and we have seen that.
Well, we have a grant. I'm not sure if you're familiar with an organization which is headed by a former tech transfer director. It's called VentureWell.
Yes, familiar with VentureWell. Yep.
Well, we have a grant from VentureWell to try to do that, to try to develop some educational material. Yeah, you can even call it marketing. I think some of it is kind of like marketing on campus. But to try to get more minorities engaged in tech transfer as a profession. Let me give you an example. And this is the one we used in our grant proposal. So I think it worked because we got the grant. We said, look, ASU has 31,000 engineers. Do you believe that?
That's an incredible number of engineers.
There are very few universities in the country that have more than 31,000 students. Now, you know, not too many.
Let alone engineers.
Let alone engineers. So we obviously have, and we do have, as I said, we take our mission very seriously as a state university. So, you know, we have a lot, the most women and the most minority, the most Native American, the most Hispanic engineers of anyone. And so we said, look, if we can, you know, get a very small percentage of those engineers, and we just used engineering as an example. We also have large programs in science, not just in engineering. Then we can, you know, maybe address this problem with tech transfer as a profession. And by the way, that's the other major trend. You know, Autumn was very small in the 90s, but now it's grown as a profession and grown as an organization, but we still have some problems in terms of DEI. And we said, well, part of the problem is that your science and engineering, you know, we have all these programs to encourage minorities and women into STEM careers, but we don't have a specific program to gear them towards a career as a tech transfer professional. And so that's what we're going to do.
That's great. It's very much needed. So that's going to be fascinating to see how your program works out. I know the Autumn EDI committee will be very excited about that. That's very exciting. So Don, as we wrap up the podcast here, I wanted to ask you, what are the three key takeaways that you'd like to highlight from your handbook?
Well, I know this is a audience that's mostly practitioners. So I'm going to give you what I think is the major conclusion regarding tech transfer offices and tech transfer as a function at the university. And I think that one of the problems that we have is that the university is not treating it as a major strategic issue. So one of the main conclusions of the handbook is that whoever manages the university, okay, now, ideally, that would be the president, but if not, the provost or the VPR, really has to think about tech transfer as a major strategic issue. And what that means, as someone who teaches strategy, is they have to deal with a set of formulation. So strategy can be, you know, kind of split up into formulation issues and then implementation. What is a tech transfer strategy? Well, the first objective has to be, you know, is this an important priority at the institution? So you have to be able to set goals, institutional goals, and priorities. Is it important or, you know, perhaps it's not. I've been at some universities where it really hasn't been an important priority. Number two, if it is a priority, then resources should reflect that. You know, this gets back to the issue, what's the major problem that TTOs face? They're under-resourced. So if TTOs, you know, when I was at ASU before Michael Crow, there were 1.5 FTEs in tech transfer and probably 60 or so in the athletic office. Now, what does that tell me about the priorities of my institution?
Yeah, exactly. 1.5 FTEs versus 60. Yeah.
Exactly. So if it is a priority, then resources should reflect that. Then there's the question of which modes of tech transfer do you want to stress? And we learned about this when we first started interviewing tech transfer officers. You know, it was clear in some institutions what the priority was. When I interviewed Lita Nelson, the legend, right? She made it clear to me. I said, who's your customer? And I thought she was going to say the faculty or something like that, or industry. No, she said the federal government. The federal government is my customer. And many, you know, you have to decide, are you going to stress patents, licensing, or are you going to stress startups, or are you going to stress sponsored research, as many other universities do? What about other tech transfer mechanisms that stimulate and more directly stimulate economic development? Are you going to stress incubators and accelerators? Are you going to stress science and technology parks? That's a strategic issue. So that's one takeaway. All these strategic formulation issues. Then, to make it even more complex, you have a set of implementation issues. Once you've decided it's a priority and you're going to spend a lot of money on it and you're going to focus on startups, well, you better make sure that your department chairs, your deans, you know, I've seen situations where the university has an overall strategy, but the college deans and department chairs are not aligned with that strategy. So you have to make sure that your university leaders are on board with that. And you also have to figure out how to structure tech transfer. That's a big issue. And you know this because you're in the field, but a university like Johns Hopkins actually has three tech transfer offices. They have one for applied physics, they have one for the medical school, and one for the rest of the university. So they decentralize, right? Others, most universities only have one, but some have, you know, one for life sciences, one in medicine, and maybe one for the engineering and physical science and other things. So you have to figure out how to structure it. Then, of course, there's human resource management practices. How are you rewarding tech transfer in promotion and tenure, financially? Do you have a reward system? If it is a priority, then it should be reflected in the reward system. And then you have all kinds of implementation issues that come up depending on what mode of tech transfer you want to stress. If you want to stress startups, there's two ways, kind of models for this. Some universities rely almost completely on their faculty. Others hire so-called surrogate entrepreneurs who come to campus, who try to, inject the entrepreneurial spirit among the faculty and students. They rely on people who are entrepreneurs, real entrepreneurs, to come to campus rather than waiting for faculty to assume that role. You know, that's one issue. I would say that tech transfer has become so important at all universities, all research universities, that it needs to be taken seriously as a strategic issue by the president of the university and key research officials. I think that's the main issue, the main takeaways, particularly for your audience.
Well, Don, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating discussion today. And thank you for all the work that you do researching tech transfer. And we can't wait to see some of your results as they continue to be published.
Thank you. And I look forward to seeing you at the next autumn meeting. I believe it's in Washington.
It's in Washington to celebrate the 50th anniversary of autumn. So we're all looking forward to that.
That's really great. Thank you.
A big thank you to Don for sharing his valuable insights and expertise with us today. For those interested in diving deeper, you can find the Chicago Handbook of University Technology Transfer and Academic Entrepreneurship online through Google Books. It's a comprehensive resource you won't want to miss.
Thanks for listening to Autumn on the Air with Lisa Mueller. Get social with us and share your thoughts. You can tweet us at AUTM or visit us online at AUTM.net. We'll be back next week on the air. Be sure to join us.